you can explore an exclusive collection of case law at Decisus Law Reports. Browse a comprehensive collection of nearly 14,000 reports of Irish legal judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisus.ie to find out more.
Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 65 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard, barrister.
Myself, Mark Tottenham, barrister and editor of Decisus Law Reports.
Mark, good to see you as always. And what about that last week? The most fascinating discussion with barrister Zeldine O'Brien about the law of outer space. I mean, the amount of people who remarked on that interview.
Yeah,
it was brand new, wasn't it? It was
brand
really
new
good.
Frontier for the Fifth Court, and
yes,
probably for most of our listeners.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, it was really, really, really good. A fantastic interview. If you've missed it, folks, listen back. It really is interesting. And Mark, before we go any further, Wild Atlantic Law School.
Yeah, 1st and 2nd of May, the Wild Atlantic Law Festival of Legal Ideas. A number of very interesting topics going to be discussed, and we will be appearing as the Fifth Court doing a live interview, which will later be broadcast or podcasted to our listeners.
No, really looking forward to that. It's going to be fun. Yeah. Come on down to the west of Ireland, Enniskillen.
And I mean,
where can you go wrong?
Year to go to.
Absolutely. Well, tonight we're delighted to welcome Saoirse Brady to studio. And Saoirse is the Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust. And we're going to talk to her about all things to do with prisons and whether prison is the answer for criminal wrongdoing. I'm sure it has to be in lots of cases, but maybe there are alternatives that we need to explore. I think Saoirse is going to be big
certainly
on that.
I think the Penal Reform Trust has very interesting views on, for example, mental health issues arising in jails.
Yeah. And also there's very interesting research about the fact that employers out there, the big bad employer, is willing to give prisoners a chance.
Could be something to do with the fact that there's something of a labour shortage.
Well, it might be that. Maybe we can look at it as something more positive as well, Mark. Maybe
every cloud and all that, you know.
Oh, you're very cynical. But first, we're going to look at three cases that you have identified from the Decisus website. The first case this week concerns the costs of a judicial review brought against a decision of the legal costs adjudicator. It was agreed by the parties that the decision should be set aside. But then again, who was going to be responsible for the costs? This was Kenny versus the legal costs adjudicator, and it's a decision of Justice Power.
Yes, yeah, so the so it's a judicial review, as you said, of a decision of the legal costs adjudicator, where the respondent in the case before the cost adjudicator was a solicitor. The client who was having his costs assessed brought judicial review of the decision. And the solicitor said, well, I'll agree to the decision being set aside, provided I'm not liable for my costs. But he proceeded to bring the claim before the High Court. The High Court, effectively by consent, set it aside. And then the applicant said, well, I'd like my costs against the solicitor. And the High Court looked at how the decision was made in the first place and said, well, there's insufficient evidence that the solicitor asked for this particular decision to be made by the legal cost adjudicator in the first place and didn't contest the judicial review. So at the end of the day, the applicant ended up having to foot the costs of the solicitor.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, now moving to our second case, and this concerned the Gardaí who had brought a district court prosecution for a breach of COVID travel regulations. The accused sought judicial review to restrain the prosecution on the grounds that a fixed penalty notice was not in the correct form. And this is the case of Mazarash versus the Commissioner of An Garda Síochána. And it's a decision of Ms. Justice Jackson.
Yeah, basically, we're all familiar with fixed penalty notices when it comes to driving issues. They brought in these fixed penalty notices in relation to COVID. And what the applicant said here was the fixed penalty notice didn't comply with the legislation and therefore sought judicial review to restrain the prosecution arising from it. And what the court said was, well, a fixed penalty notice is not comparable to something like a district court summons. If there's an error on the notice, that in itself doesn't render the prosecution bad on its face. And so therefore, the court did not grant judicial review.
Okay, very good. Okay, and finally, we come to a case concerning data protection and the Irish language. This is one Conall O'Moroyne will be tuning into, no doubt. Specifically, whether computer systems were able to process fathers in Irish names. This is the case of Despoine versus Comisión Cosant Sonroy. And that's a decision of Mr. Justice Ferreter, who heard the case Osgaillia.
And delivered the judgment of Osgaillia,
which is incredibly impressive.
Interestingly, when you put this decision through Google Translate, which I must admit I did before preparing for this.
How are the fathers?
Well, the curious thing is when you read it, it says, it talks about processing Irish names and addresses with long extensions. It took me a while to realize that a long extension was a father.
So, okay. Very anyway, good. Very good.
So you know, it is interesting because basically what the applicant here complained to the Data Protection Commission that certain banks and airline computer systems had his name and address stored, but there was no fodder there. And there are language rights which effectively include the fact that you're entitled to have your name and address properly stored.
Yes, absolutely.
And so the issue there was whether the computer systems were able to process the fodders. And really the issue, it was accepted by the Data Protection Commission that they had made the wrong decision. And the issue really before the court was, can the court substitute its own decision or does it need to be remitted back to the Data Protection Commission? And what the court held here, Mr. Justice Ferreter said that there was insufficient expert evidence before him in relation to the operation of the particular computer systems. And so the matter had to go back to the, as you said so well, Comisión Cosant Sonroy.
Okay, very good. Yeah, you did a slightly better job than me with that. Okay, thank you for that, Mark. Very well explained. And we're back shortly with Saoirse Brady.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
So our guest in this week's episode of the Fifth Court is Saoirse Brady, who is the director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust and an experienced human rights lawyer and advocate. Saoirse, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Ian.
So can you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you get into human rights?
I suppose I grew up, as you can probably tell from my accent, I grew up in the north. I'm from Newry, but I've grown up during the Troubles and I suppose always had an interest in civil rights and human rights, even in school, and then went on to study law in UCD, where I was actually a classmate of Peter.
Absolutely.
So we, you know, I always kind of had in mind that I wanted to go into kind of the human rights world. I never really wanted to practice as such. I remember making sure that human rights was on my list of options. And then, yeah, I did that. Wanted to take a little break from law as well. So went off and did a master's in UCD as well on European studies. And then ended up working for the Ryan Commission as a paralegal for a couple of years.
And that was to do with children's homes?
That was a child, yeah, it was the industrial schools. Around child abuse in industrial schools and was obviously pretty harrowing, but really rewarding work actually. And, you know, it was really interesting because you saw people there who were older, but regressed into themselves and they were telling their story about what had happened to them. But also, interestingly, I was meeting people my own age who were in the deaf schools. And that, to me, was really kind of, you know, opened my eyes quite a lot about how recent that was. So I did that for a while. And then I ended up working with an organisation called Frontline Defenders. They work with human rights defenders around the world. And I got to do an internship with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights over in Geneva and really enjoyed that. And always thought I'd kind of go into the international
Is
human
that the
rights
office that Mary sphere. Robinson had
it
run?
It was.
And was she still there when you were
she
there?
She wasn't, okay, but her memory was the guy who used to bring the poster around used to love all the Irish people because Mary was, you know, was his top person. And, you know, any Irish intern that came in, he would come and like welcome them personally. It was great. She left such a legacy there. So I worked there for 6 months. Came back and then was applying for jobs and ended up actually working with the Free Legal Advice Centres and focusing on social welfare law reform, which is ironic because my father worked in welfare rights and, you know, up in Newry, and I never thought I'd go into that area, but did. And then ended up in children's rights as well, worked for the Children's Rights Alliance for a good 9 years or so, did a bit of consultancy, worked with human rights bodies there, and then ended up applying for the job with the Irish Penal Reform Trust. And I always knew about them. I'd worked closely with them over the years. Didn't really ever see myself there. But when the job came up, I went, you know what? Actually, a lot of what I'm working on in the children's rights sphere on child poverty relates to this. You're talking about the same people who end up interacting with the criminal justice system. So while it seems illogical, for me, it was a logical step to kind of go for it.
And just before we go into the IPRT, you obviously talk about yourself as a human rights lawyer, and as we discussed recently with Darren Mackin in this show, I mean, human rights doesn't kind of have the same meaning in this jurisdiction as it might do in the North. I mean, you know, we most of our fundamental rights are protected by the Constitution. What does it, in terms of human rights, what does that mean to you?
I suppose, well, I look at it from an international perspective, and obviously, like when you're talking about human rights in Ireland, and obviously I studied here, so, you know, the Irish Constitution has a real impact on my thinking around human rights as well. But when you're thinking about human rights, you think about it from the international perspective and think about the dignity of the person. And, you know, how can we afford them those rights? How can they vindicate those rights? To me, that's really how you try and move your way through it. You know, like we always get told in the civil society sphere, don't talk about rights when you're on media because people switch off. So you have to make it about the people themselves. And I think, you know, having grown up in the North, having thought about what civil rights mean, you know, like I suppose we're very focused on civil rights in the North, but actually, were they just civil rights? They were the socioeconomic rights. And, you know, I know there's a lot of debate about that at the moment, obviously, and whether or not they're enforceable. And I suppose a lot of my work, particularly with FLAC, would have been around the socioeconomic rights and whether or not they were enforceable in law or not. And, you know, we know that very often they aren't.
Yeah, well, Saoirse, it is great to see you again. As you said, we go all the way back to UCD around the turn of the millennium,
yes,
the glory days. And could I just ask you a question? And we're going to talk about the Irish Penal Trust, a reform trust. But why did you not want to become a kind of a lawyer, an everyday lawyer like everybody else? You know, get one of those jobs down on the quays and make loads of money.
I'm going to say the paperwork. No, I suppose, and I like that's funny because obviously there's a huge amount of paperwork when you work for civil society organisations as well. But no, I thought, it was the human stories piece that really interested me and how you can actually support people to move those along. And the research piece, I really enjoy that piece of it. Looking at, you know, setting up what the rights are, what the current situation is in Ireland, and then how you can actually, what recommendations you can make to improve that, that will get buy-in from government or the state or the policymakers or legislators that you need to move on those things.
Yes, okay. And I mean, I know your family had a very strong tradition in academic law, and people will hear the surname Brady and they'll probably make their own connections in relation to that. But you have steered away from kind of the practice of everyday law, but you've also got involved in law and human rights at a very practical level. You know, with the organizations that try and implement change. Isn't that it?
Yeah, and it's that social change piece that I think really appeals to me and I think is really important. Obviously, I think, you know, what you guys do, what other practicing lawyers do in the courts is hugely important. But we know if you want to implement change, it's very incremental, as we know. Not everybody can afford to go to court to vindicate their rights. And, you know, I suppose in FLAC, we would have focused very much on that access to justice piece and looking at, you know, other mechanisms to do that, whether it's trying to change the law through advocacy, whether it's, you know, trying to use other tribunals, you know, that don't necessarily need a lawyer to go to them. You know, I would have done a lot of work in social welfare appeals, for example.
Okay.
You know, so I think it's complementing what can happen in the courts as well.
Okay, very good. And let's go back to the Irish Penal Reform Trust. I, doing a little bit of research for this interview, discovered that it only existed since 1994.
Yes.
I would have thought this was much longer established. So it's relatively recent. I mean, 30 years.
Yeah.
30,
yeah,
you 30th must be celebrating.
Yeah,
30th
yeah.
anniversary.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so tell us more. Why was it set up then and how has it developed?
So it was set up by a small group of kind of concerned citizens who were worried about what was happening behind the high prison walls without any kind of spotlight being shone on that. And I suppose when you think about it, this was a time when we have Victorian prisons, when slopping out is a key feature, where young men, 16 and 17 year olds, are imprisoned in St. Patrick's Institution and not treated as children, which they are because they're under 18. So they came together and wanted to try and put human dignity at the heart of what was happening in the Irish penal system.
Sorry, can I just ask, were there not prison visiting committees and various other kind of, I mean, I think the Quakers have always had a long tradition of kind of, you know, keeping an eye on what goes on in prisons. I mean, were there not other organisations like that?
There were people going into prisons, but even today, it's quite sporadic. You know, there are prison visiting committees and actually there's reform going on with those at the moment. those were very often seen as political appointments as well. Yeah. I was in...
Quite good expenses, I see.
Well, I was just going to say, I was in a joint committee, Oireachtas Committee on Justice, not so long ago, and Michael McDougall, former Minister for Justice, was there and was talking about how he knew that people were appointed to a visiting committee on the other side of the country so they could claim the mileage.
Well, there you know, you go.
And I'm not saying
Ireland.
That. I'm not saying that for everyone, because there are certainly very committed people involved in prison visiting committees, but there were political appointments made way as well. Yeah.
But there is still an inspectorate of prisons, isn't there?
There is.
And that's separate. I mean, there used to be the famous district judge, the late Michael, sorry, I can't think of his name, but I know it's now Mark Kelly, who came back from Geneva himself, didn't he, to take over the position? Michael Riley, legendary district court judge in the Tipperary area once upon a time.
And Mark has now been appointed as the Chief Inspector of Prisons, and he has a very long history with the Committee on the Prevention of Torture in Strasbourg. So, you know, he's an ideal person, really, because he does have that oversight. He's been around prisons all around the coast of Europe, so he knows what conditions are. And actually, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because one of the things, I suppose, that we are pushing for in the Irish Penal Reform Trust that's related to that is around the ratification of the optional protocol for the Convention Against Torture. You know, Ireland signed it in 2007. We're still waiting. It was a commitment in this programme for government that it would be done within the first 18 months of this government. Right. It hasn't happened yet. It's on the priority list for drafting for legislation. But, you know, we are starting to look towards the end of this government's term, and we would like to see that implemented. And that would mean that actually the remit of the Office of the Inspector of Prisons would grow. It would become the Inspectorate of Places of Detention. So it would include Garda stations. It would include vehicles that transport people to and from court. And then there would be a thing put in place called a national preventative mechanism. So that would really try and ensure that there was prevention of ill treatment or torture within the Irish penal system.
And can I just jump in there, Saoirse, and ask you about that? I mean, you know, is that something necessary in the Irish system? Yes, it is.
Actually, just still on the Office of the Inspector of Prisons, they released a report last week. It was a thematic inspection on mental health or psychiatric services for people in prison. We have a huge mental health crisis within our prison system. We see vast numbers of people being sent to prison who have severe mental health issues, or maybe not so severe mental health issues, but they are not getting the treatment and services that they need.
Can I just continue with this? Does that amount to ill treatment and torture, though? That's my question.
For some people, yes. Like, you know, in that report they were talking about, they had two individuals that they named, or they didn't name them, but they called them Prisoner A and Prisoner B. We were talking about, in Prisoner A's case, somebody who was in Mountjoy, in solitary confinement, more or less. They were in a cell that was littered with food, with rubbish. They'd stopped taking their medication. They were lying there staring into space. Nobody could communicate with them, really. They were urinating on the floor. They actually had to keep two cells so that person could switch cells every couple of days so they could clean them. We have the word degrading is mentioned a number of times in that report, actually.
Okay.
You know, you have people sleeping on mattresses, over 100 people sleeping on mattresses on the floor, where people have to step over them to get to the toilet that's beside their bed. So I would say that's degrading.
I mean, the case you're talking about brings us back to the old Sean McBride case, doesn't it? Where there was a Republican prisoner who was kept naked in a cell for years, and he asked the question, would you treat a dog in that fashion? And the answer was no.
Yeah.
Isn't that correct? And it's something not dissimilar is still happening today.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's because of the overcrowding issue. This is one of the things that is really, I suppose we were making good strides, maybe, in terms of the numbers starting to go down in terms of the prison population. We were now at a point, like I checked the numbers just before I came, and on Friday we were at 107% capacity for people within the prison system. We're heading towards 5,000 people in the prison system.
Can I ask you about what I believe is called the Penrose effect? This is where psychiatric hospitals have been closed down in a lot of countries, and there's a corresponding rise in prison populations. And, I mean, I know from my own criminal practice, you know, a lot of the people you deal with, you're not talking about bad people. You're talking about people who often have addiction problems, who clearly have very difficult upbringings, to put it mildly. You know, there are a lot of factors that have led them to where they are when they come before the courts. And to take somebody who isn't necessarily a violent offender and then put them into a place where they might be housed with a lot of violent offenders, it's obviously not, should we say, a suboptimal solution.
Yeah, and this is happening. You know, we have, we don't know exact numbers of how many people experience mental health difficulties in prison. But at the same time, you know, there was a task force set up by this government to look at mental health and addiction issues of people who come into contact with the criminal justice system. And they made a series of recommendations around that. And I suppose one of the things, and at the same time, another piece of policy came out, which was a review of policy options for prison and penal reform. And it talked about trying to reduce the number of people going to prison on short-term sentences of less than 12 months for those less serious offences. Because at the moment, if you look at the IPS, the Irish Prison Service annual report for 2022, 74% of committals were for 12 months or less. Now, you might have some people in for multiple offences.
Sure.
I'm not saying that you won't. So it's not 74% of people per se. But at the same time, that is a stark enough figure. So we need to start working out how you reduce the number of people going to prison. We're actually seeing more women come into contact with the criminal justice system overall, both in prison in terms of custody and in terms of the probation service. So if you're only seeing that in the probation service, you go, okay, something's right. People are serving a sentence in the community instead of going to prison. But actually, we're seeing the net widen a little bit.
So are we saying that there's too many people being sent to jail? I mean, I've had some dealings with the Irish Prison Service. And I mean, I know, let's say, governors who are running the nation's cohort of prisoners, I mean, they don't know how many prisoners are going to be sent down at any particular time. You know, suddenly the courts will send people to jail and then they have to deal with them. They have to house them and they're under pressure. I mean, they're probably understaffed. They don't have sufficient accommodation. Mm-hmm. You know, numbers are rising. So, like, what can they do in those circumstances?
Well, the Irish Prison Service would say they have to take whoever
the
courts send to them. So, you know, they have been involved in these various policy pieces that I've talked about, and they do feel that there needs to be a step taken. We need to see more community-based sanctions being used. We know that the courts do use them, but we also know that maybe they're used in some parts of the country, you know, rather than others, or they're used by some judges more than others. And there's actually reviews going on by the Department of Justice at the moment to see why that is. You know, we have legislation that was brought in 2011. We saw, you know, it being used quite regularly. And then we've seen a dip in the number of community-based sanctions that are given. So we need to fathom out why, but we also need to see a reduction in the number of people going to prison overall. But
it sounds, from what you're saying, as if there needs to be some kind of halfway house between a prison per se and something like Portrane, where Portrane obviously is to house the people who are not guilty by reason of insanity, or, you know, people who simply don't have the mens rea.
Yeah.
But then, from what you're saying, there's a large number of people in prison who have mental health difficulties who effectively need to be treated rather than punished, for want of a better term, or maybe a bit of both. I mean, you know, they've done things that the courts have decided to sentence them for, but they need treatment as well. And is it fair to say that there simply aren't the resources for that treatment?
Yeah, I would say a few things there. So one, there's a waiting list to get into Portrane.
Oh, sure.
And I've been out to the new Central Mental Hospital. Lovely facility, vast improvement on what was there before. But, you know, there is a waiting list to get in there. And that's why Prisoner A and Prisoner B in that report I mentioned, they were waiting to get in. And they were obviously at the severe end of this. But I suppose, like, I would say, you know, we have to question, you know, Mark, you mentioned people having experienced trauma in their lives. We have to wonder why some people get to the point that they commit an offence or a crime when they've reached crisis levels in terms of their mental health. And if we could invest in the supports that would be put in place to prevent them going, you know, reaching that crisis point in the first place, that would serve everybody. It would serve the individual themselves, their families, communities. It would result in safer communities, and we wouldn't have the overstretched prison service that we currently have. So I think there is something that we need to kind of go back to basics on this and think about the investment, where we are putting investment. You know, there's a huge discussion now around we need more prison spaces. I would argue that we don't. We actually need to reinvest that money or reimagine how we invest that money. You talked there as well about, you know, a halfway house or whatever between the Central Mental Hospital and prison. One of the things that we're actually looking at the moment is smaller scale detention houses. We're part of a European movement called Rescaled. And they actually have detention houses, which are smaller institutions. Some of them are social enterprises, so actually end up funding themselves. But they prepare people for reintegration into the community. They are more humane. They're more like a home than a big, giant institution, which is having a very negative impact on mental health and well-being. You know, I talked about people having to step over others to get to the toilet. You know, we're a membership organization, so we have members who are in prison. They get in touch with us either by letter, sometimes by phone if we're on their call list. But they would tell us that this is the first time they've ever had to share a cell.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But and I mean, I think that's a very interesting development. And potentially, I think that would be, you know, something that would be very relevant and very helpful. But don't we have some sort, we have open prisons here, don't we? We have like Shelton Abbey, for example.
Yeah, you know, two and, open prisons. Yeah. Shelton Abbey and Loughnan House.
Yeah, in Cavan.
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, that allows the Irish Prison Service yeah. and, you know, the prison governors to kind of allow prisoners who are about to rejoin society mm-hmm. and kind of assimilate back into society. It gives them a little bit of an opportunity to do that. So that's yeah. a kind of a form of what you're talking
yeah,
about.
And reskilled actually is, came yeah. over to Shelton Abbey to have a look at it.
Okay.
And I've been down to Shelton Abbey myself. And yeah, you know, there's a lot of good practice happening there, actually. We'd like to see more of it replicated.
Can I, before I go, and I want to go in a different direction now, mm-hmm. but beforehand, I see there is a plan to build 400 more prison spaces. Isn't that
yes.
it? To house up to 620 more prisoners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the state obviously view things slightly differently to the way you see things, Saoirse. Is that the case?
They do. But we okay. would say that, you know, there's an argument that with an increase in population, with, an increase in the number of offences that are coming online, that you need more prison spaces. We would say, actually, you need more education for people. You need to invest in some of those preventative mechanisms to stop people ending up in prison in the first place.
Okay. Okay. Now, what happens when you go to prison, okay, and then you come out of prison?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's been some very, very interesting research there recently about people trying to rejoin the workforce.
Yes.
Ex-prisoners. And one would imagine that that's quite challenging. But there was very encouraging research from Maynooth to say that employers generally are quite open maybe to employing prisoners and giving them a second chance.
Yeah, so IPRT would have received funding from the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission, and we commissioned two researchers in Maynooth, Dr. Joe Garrahy and Dr. Kiara Bracken-Roach, to do this piece of research for us. So they did some surveys, they did interviews, and they had a symposium as well where they brought together employers and people with lived experience of conviction. And 9 out of 10 employers said that they would be willing to hire somebody with convictions, but they don't have the practical know-how to know what to do. They don't want to put a step wrong.
Just say that again. 9 out of 10 employers. Yeah. I think that would be a shock to most of us.
It was a small-scale study. I'm not going to say it was thousands and thousands of people, but at the same time, it was quite encouraging. And we had a launch. IBEC came along to the launch. They said it echoed what they're hearing from their members. People want to do this, but they are so afraid of putting a foot wrong and, you know, actually setting that person back in their journey towards turning their life around. So what they actually want are supports from government, not financial supports. They want a phone line where they can ring somebody who knows what they're talking about to tell them what the law actually says. When does somebody have to disclose their conviction? Or does that employer need to disclose their conviction history, this person's conviction history, to other employees? You know, people are afraid of GDPR. We're all afraid of GDPR. You know, so it was those kind of really practical things that came up in it. And they recognised that, you know, over 90% of them recognised that actually employment is a key way to kind of move away from offending. But they also recognised, over 90% of them recognised, that there are barriers to doing that. So, you know, access to employment is one piece, but we are seeing an increasing number of people coming out of prison into homelessness. So you need to have, you know, the housing piece fixed.
Yes.
You need to have a more holistic approach. They need to have the support of whether it's probation or whoever else on the ground to help them to do this. The research was actually called the secondary punishment. And it sounds
really encouraging, in fairness. Mm. And I mean, it would sound like a way of kind of knocking recidivism on mm-hmm. the head in one way. You know, let people come out and get a new start.
Yeah.
Get a job, earn a living and get on with your life.
And that's part of it, because people said when they left the prison gate, they thought, oh, my sentence is done. Sure, I can start my life again. Not realising that it would impact their conviction sure. history, would impact every part of their life. Not just employment, but like applying for insurance, car insurance, sure. you know, whether or not they can coach their child or get involved in their child's sports sure. team, even if their offence had nothing to do with children or anything else, do you know? So...
Can I bring you just onto the issue of the Oberst Town Centre?
Yes.
Because we spoke to Ursula Kilkenny a few months ago, and she certainly gave the impression that there were huge improvements there in terms of the rehabilitation of young offenders. And she also said that there was now an engagement between Oberst Town and the prison service in terms of young offenders, you know, people who are sort of still kind of coming out of childhood, aged kind of 18 to 22, 23. Is that your experience as well?
Yes, so we went out to Oberst Town actually in November. Our whole team went out to meet with the team out there. And, you know, from my previous roles with the Children's Rights Alliance, I would know that Oberst Town is seen as best practice, you know, in terms of it does have a child rights ethos. I suppose one encouraging thing is that the Irish Youth Justice Strategy actually looks at extending the age of, you know, it doesn't just stop at 18. We're looking at, you know, up to 24-year-olds because we know the science says that brain development stops at 25, and that's Harvard research. So, you know, young people don't always understand the consequences of what they've done. So we need to kind of get with the times and think about that. So that's encouraging. What they did tell us was that they are doing a lot of work with Wheatfield prison because that is where a young person would be transferred to. But it can still be very traumatic. And I know I would have listened to the piece with Ursula. And Oberst Town is a school. It is a very different environment. You have young people then turning 18, going into a prison environment, which is very harsh, which is nothing like they've experienced before. You know, people in Oberst Town told us about how the young people were so afraid of going to adult prison.
But there has to be a cutoff, surely, doesn't there?
There does, but they are looking at how you could maybe have phased facilities, you know, for those young people, knowing that like it's a cliff edge, that they're just going straight from something that's quite protective. It's around
and
education.
It's a detention school, but it is a school. Yeah.
And the other thing I would say about Oberst Town is HICWA, the Health Information Quality Authority, inspect Oberst Town, and they did release a report last week on this. And I suppose there were a couple of concerning things for us in it, in terms of obviously they talked about the child rights ethos and how everyone there is bought into it. And that is really, that's great. But I suppose there were a couple of things around child protection. You know, there were staff shortages. So child protection trainings were deferred. Not all of the concerns, child protection concerns, were reported to TUSLA. And it wasn't always clear why. And because of the staff shortages, young people ended up staying longer in their rooms and talking about the impact that that had on their mental health and well-being. Sure. So, you know, Oberst Town is much improved. There's a lot of great practice going on there, but, you know, there are also issues that still need to be addressed, I would say.
We're coming close to the end. I just wanted to ask you very briefly about spent convictions legislation. Mm-hmm. How long after your release can you effectively, are you allowed to deny your conviction, so to speak?
Well, it depends on the convictions as well. So it's 7 years at the moment. So the spent convictions legislation was changed in 2016. So if you served a 1 year prison term and or a 2 year community service, then your conviction can become spent after 7 years in some instances. So those would usually be the kind of convictions that are handed down in the district court and maybe the circuit court. But more serious offences, some of them can never be spent. And if you've multiple convictions, they can never be spent. So there is a piece of legislation, a private member's bill. It was introduced by Senator Lynn Ruan in 2018. It fell with the last government, was picked back up again. The current government have said they would support it with some amendments. And I've spoken to the Minister for Justice about this. And she said, yes, look, you know, there is cross-party support. We would need to make some small amendments to it. So we're awaiting time in the Dáil. We would love to see that done before the end of this year. And that would...
Do you think that should be expanded, Saoirse? Is that beyond one year, two years, five years maybe?
Well, the current bill won't go as far as that. But we would say, yes, we should be looking at that in terms of, you know, really, I suppose part of the rationale for the bill that is currently before the Dáil is that people commit a lot of offences in a short space of time at a chaotic point in their lives. Yep. We should be looking at how long it's been since they've done that, not how many times they did a certain thing. So this would, extend or it would shorten the amount of time that since you've committed the offence, but it would also look at expanding it in terms of the number of offences that you've committed that you could actually spend it at some point. So we would like to see it, at least the current bill enacted, and then that would give us a chance to kind of, you know, look at how, you know, we'd look at what impact that has on people, whether or not that's enough, and, you know, whether we should go further. We know they are going further in places like Scotland and
Saoirse, before we get to our final question, Mark will have a final question for you. Mm-hmm. But can I just, overarching question, you know, people listening to this, there'll be people driving along in a car and the night before they'll have woken up to find that somebody maybe broke into their garden shed and robbed something important belonging to them. And, you know, all of this, they will say, this is all pro-prisoner. This is all about, you know, let's look after the people who have done wrong here, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, is this kind of do-goodery, you know, what do you say when people say, you know, well, look, you know, we need to have a system of sanctions. We need to penalise people who have done wrong, who have broken the criminal law. And that should be the focus rather than let's rehabilitate all these people.
You know, I can understand why people think that. And I think, like, what we really need to, and one of the things that we are advocating for, is looking at sentencing, for example, and looking at the principles of sentencing. So at the moment, you know, the Sentencing Guidelines Information Committee is meant to be producing guidelines. And this is a judicial council body, and we would welcome that. But we need to think about what the principles are for sentencing. We need to think about, we're, you know, yes, I am a do-gooder. I own that label.
Hear, hear.
But at the same time, I understand that we have a criminal justice system.
Yes.
But we all want safer communities. We want it to be effective. So one of the other things that we would talk about a lot are, you know, people serving a sentence in the community and, you know, having the wraparound supports, like that helps reduce recidivism. Do you know, if they are able to maintain employment, if they're able to maintain housing, if they have it, family relationships are key. We have a whole dedicated project on children and family relationships. So we need to look at those things as well. We need to kind of question why people might have committed that crime in the first place.
Yes, of course.
As well.
I mean, look, there's always going to be social issues. I have to say, I think one of the most encouraging things is this notion of 9 out of 10 employers. Now, as you say, it's a small survey, so let's not get overly excited. But it does suggest, you know, a kind of an openness in society to integrate people.
Yeah.
And that has to be a really good thing. Mark?
Yeah. Afraid we've reached our final question. Saoirse, do you have a book or a film you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
There's a few, I'm sure. One book, and I know somebody else recommended this on the podcast before, but I think, you know, particularly in that last point that we talked about, Katrina O'Sullivan's book, her autobiography, Named Poor, I think it really talks about, you know, how people end up in certain situations and the key role that education can play. And she was actually, you know, she talks about her father going to prison and the impact that that would have had in the family as well. So I think from that point of view, I would say that book. From a more international perspective, I might say Brian Stevenson's Just Mercy. Again, looking at kind of the criminal justice system.
He's the American advocate who's appeared before the Supreme Court a few times, isn't that right?
Yes, and he would have actually come over for one of the FLAC annual lectures a few years ago. I met him in Boston. He's an amazing man. And
quite a good TED talk a few years ago.
Yeah, and the book is really gripping as well, but talks about like what he's done in that sphere, you know, not only with people on death row, but people in the juvenile justice system, which is very different to our own youth justice system. But I would really encourage people to do that. I know they made a film of it. I haven't seen it yet. It's on my list.
Well, I'm getting very excited about what movie you're going to pick now, Saoirse, you know? Has to be Escape from Alcatraz, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I joke.
Yeah.
No, but anyway, any movies that appeal to you? With a prison theme, come on, there's been many.
You know, I don't know, because I don't know how accurate they all are.
Fair enough.
I think they depict something in maybe a storybook light, and it isn't always like that, unfortunately.
Well, we're exactly like, you know, Henry Fonda in, you know, 12 Angry Men all the time. So I don't know what you're talking about. But anyway, that's it.
Yeah.
Saoirse Brady, Mark, do you want to say?
Yeah. Saoirse, thank you very much for joining us here in the Fifth Court.
Oh, thank you so much.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
So that's all from this edition of the Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Can we say a huge thank you to Saoirse Brady, Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust, for coming in to talk to us about the world of incarceration. And I think she believes there's a lot of better alternatives out there, Mark.
Well, it's very difficult to look
interview.
At the prison system and think that it is the ideal way of dealing with offenders. I mean, you know, it may be the least worst way, but if there are better ways to be found, then I think we should explore them.
Yes, absolutely. And I thought Saoirse set out her ideas in relation
to
that. absolutely brilliantly. And it was great for me to meet her again because we were old classmates many moons ago. So all good. Before I go, I would like to say a huge thank you to our producer, Cunnell O'Moran. Cunnell, how are you out there? Thank you for all you do for us on every week. And it's absolutely brilliant and really appreciated. And also a huge thank you to Lee Brennan from Dublin South Podcast Studios for their wonderful work in recording this show. So from me, Peter Leonard.
Myself, Mark Tottenham.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.
Never miss a vital Irish legal judgment. Check out Decisis Law Reports, where you'll find a fully indexed collection of all Irish judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisis.ie to find out more.